There's a sign upon your door. Gone fishing.
How real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hoe out in the sun, where you left a row half done. You claim
that
hoeing
sounds about like me.
No
even fun. A row half
but
done.
I can prove it.
You ain't yeah. got it's, no ambition. Yeah.
But your problem gone is you've fishing. Got a lot of rows.
Yeah, I might have more than one or two rows to work on. I guess that's probably about true. Anyway, Fish and Frank here, and this is an episode of God and Fishing, but we're missing Pastor Donnie. He's actually in the Philippines right now and getting together. He's adopting a baby over there. I think a baby girl, it's like a two-year-old girl. So he's really excited. So him and his wife are over in the Philippines getting all that done. And we're holding down the fort here. Fish and Frank here. Captain Barry, our man in the middle. And Captain Kale, our guest. And we have Joshua from Marker 54 Lures. And we're going to be getting into it. Anybody feeling really spiritual and want to take a little bit of shot at Donnie's stuff?
Doesn't sound like it.
Okay. Well, right now, just pretend Donnie is doing a really cool prayer. As Donnie always does. Okay. So we're going to do that. Amen. Yes, that was our prayer of the day. And we're going to think spiritually, but, you know, that's kind of Donnie's thing, and he's really good at it. So anyway, what we're going to do is this is a lure. I met Joshua. He came into the store, and I think I'm one of your first customers in Florida, aren't I?
You are the first customer.
I was the first guy in Florida to sell Marker 54 shrimp. And the guys are playing with them at the table. So initial reactions, guys.
I like it.
Okay.
Well, we're holding like a shrimp imitation here, is what Josh gave us to look at. And it's very unique, and it's going to flick backwards, like naturally.
Like a shrimp should.
Now, here's the thing about it, though. Not all of them do that. You got to look at the way the hook is pointed, and that's the direction the shrimp's going to go. Some of them go head first, like a common one. Some of them, when you look at the point of the hook, is pointing backwards, and they pop backwards.
Right.
Right.
So there's two different types of them in there. Do you have any of your hard body stuff in here?
We didn't bring the hard body. Didn't bring them with me. I had to give out all the samples earlier today to some guys I met down at the river. But the backward shrimp actually does both. It glides forward upon release, but when you pop it, it rises vertically like a live shrimp.
Not a lot of people realize that shrimp don't swim backwards. Shrimp swim forwards like any other animal out there.
Yeah, they swim and walk head first.
They escape backwards.
Backwards, exactly.
Well, it's a line of sight issue with a shrimp. If they have that great big tail, and if they can pop that a few times, they're going to get out of the line of sight. Say if a fish is coming at them, and they can pop off to the left side and get away from their field of vision of the predator, then
he survives.
So that's what that big tail is for, is escape mode, but it's to get out of the line of sight. Yeah. And so you've got that big tail, but on a normal day, a shrimp swims along just kind of lazy and not really. They're not really quick.
Well, that's true, but if this was a shrimp that was designed to cohort with other shrimp, but this is a shrimp that's designed to interact with trout. And if you ask a trout, if you had a trout sitting here, he's probably never seen a shrimp go forwards, because every time he's interacting with a shrimp,
they're going backwards. Right.
And so the natural motion to your reds, your snook, and your trout are a backwards shrimp.
Sure.
But this does a lot more than that. This is what we call vertical fishing. So most of the lures we use nowadays, like paddle tails, you cast and retrieve, and it moves along in a horizontal motion.
Yep.
My lures move through the water in a vertical motion. So at 30 yards out, you pop the rod tip three times, it jumps straight up out of the water.
Right.
Your cast takes a minute and a half.
Like a normal shrimp does.
So when your customers are fidgety and they just can't slow it down, they have to keep that thing moving, instead of being in 10 seconds, they can move this lure constantly, and it'll take a minute to get back. The horizontal motion is slow. The vertical action is consistent.
Right. Here's the one thing. Like you said, you've got fish going after them. It's about exciting the greed factor in a fish. And believe it or not, shrimp are some of the best bass lures I've ever used in freshwater. Because almost, I would say probably 30 states have freshwater grass shrimp. Yep. They grow up eating shrimp. Right. People don't think of that because it's freshwater. But when you take a bass in freshwater, especially in Florida, from the time they're hatched, they're eating shrimp fry. And even through adults, a 10-pound bass goes in amongst the grass and gets those grass shrimp out of there. It's natural food for the largemouth bass. But what we're trying to do is strike a greed motion. Sometimes when a bait is just going lazy through the water, just kind of idling along, fish may be interested, maybe not. But if something else wants to eat it, this sounds good. And that darting, flicking action is signs that another fish was trying to eat that bait. And it's the same thing when I do crankbaits. I stop them a lot because if it's in a continuous motion, it doesn't get their attention as well as a bait that's pausing, looking around like, oh, something wants to eat me, and then runs and stops.
And how many times have you caught two fish on one crankbait?
Because they want their most wonderful food in the world wants. Is the one the other fish has in its mouth.
Right.
So that greed factor is when his is popping, it's saying, something's trying to eat me.
And that's what is built into this lure. Is it, Josh, what made you want, my first question was like, what made you design a shrimp to like vertically jig it like that? Because that's not something like you see, like what?
But it is. That's the neat part. You've been throwing shrimp underneath popping corks for how long? That's just vertically jigging horizontally.
I think what he meant was you don't see it in the industry.
No, you don't.
Right. The industry shrimp travel head first, and even when they're
being
popped.
We've been doing it with natural shrimp under a popping cork for years.
Yeah. Well, that's the classic motion. The shrimp is jumping backwards around your popping cork, and you'd wish he'd lose.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
That's why I always tell people, put a split shot. If you've got a live shrimp under a popping cork, put a split shot. Not so much to keep the bait down there, but from keeping jump. Otherwise, he'll jump out of the water to get away from the fish you're trying to catch.
Yeah, the four-inch shrimp is a LeBron James of shrimp. He can get away from just about anyone. So it's pretty impressive. But back to your question, I actually lived in Fort Pierce, and I actually used to cut the tails off my DOAs, push the little weight out, and put a jig head in the back. Mm-hmm. I've just always come at things left-handed. I'm an engineer by my profession. And so we've always come at things a little bit differently. So the first lure we made sense to make a backward shrimp. The engineering to cause it to go rise vertically as opposed to backwards horizontally, which is what crawfish do, is pretty involved. We've applied for a patent on it. But essentially the point of inertia, the hook, the weight, causes the lure to rise
all
as
right,
opposed
now,
to
here's,
stretch.
He really wants to go into detail, but he's trying not to be a nerd about this. He's like you, Barry. He's really, really smart. Okay? This guy is actually a physicist. Mm-hmm. All right? Sorry. I mean, he's educated the way you are. You know, Barry's had a lot of education in his life. So you guys might be able to have him explain the actual physics of it and what weight ratio for pulling actually makes this thing work. Because if it's the wrong weight, it doesn't work, correct?
Correct.
So there's a lot of thought went into this. It's not like a simple, as I can see here, like a worm hook with like a keel weight on it. No, not at all. It's balanced very well. Is what Frank is alluding to.
It's very balanced, and there's some hard parameters in there, which is one of the reasons we could patent on a utility, not a design, which means the engineering that caused it to do something. But essentially, we use the segments in the tail as our point of inertia. It's a stop. And so, if you had a rock on the end of a string at the other end of this table, you pull it, it's going to come up over that point of inertia, which is stopping it, and it's going to rise. The hook is actually a custom bent wide gap 90. So we have to have that custom made because a standard hook won't work. We need that little vertical shank at the end to sort of increase the action. The weight is really the most dynamic part. So if my tail segments are of a certain size based upon the area, you calculate the area, the weight has to be in this one a quarter of an ounce because it's a 4-inch lure. When I scale down, even into the hard plastic, we have to reduce that weight because the tail mm-hmm. reduces. So we have to move it to 3/16. A lot of people say, can we have a 16-ounce shrimp? And I'm like, yeah, it'll be an inch and a half long. So that's why, can we get in your bass? You know, that's when the grass shrimp and the bass. So there's a profound amount of calculations. You know, we have to pay attention to the length of the legs. If the legs are too long, it causes the fish, it'll wonk to one side and it won't swim right. Okay. The other thing we really paid attention to is when it glides down, it lands on its feet. And so when you pick it, it picks up vertically. So we fish a lot of shell in Texas. So we'll land it on that oyster and pick it, and then land it back down, the hook point stays up, whereas with a jig head, you land with the head down, in a straight in the air. Mm-hmm. So we've really over-engineered the lure, but it does give us a shrimp that goes backwards, but it allows us to fish vertically from distance instead of fishing horizontally, which is not a motion the fish see a lot when on Saturday morning. Every lure that goes by them with a chartreuse tail is going
straight,
this. Mine's jumping up and down in front of them.
And you can fish this like a shrimp under a popping cork without the popping cork.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Or with a popping cork, too, as well. Sure. Like, yeah, both ways.
But you really don't need it on these.
Right. No, I get it.
Yeah, but if you're in, say, 6 feet of water, you're looking for trout or even Spanish mackerel, I want it under the popping cork it'll do its dance but stay up in the column enough where the fish are going to be to it.
Yep.
But if I'm back in 3 or 4 feet of water, I don't need the cork as much.
Right.
The only time I really want the cork is so I can tell where everybody is, so I'm not getting tangled all the time.
Right.
Bobbers are part floating the bait, part keeping them in the strike zone, and part, okay, Steve's there, Jack is there, Sally's over there, I can throw here and not be in them. When everybody's freelining, I get tangled with everybody, and I don't need
that
anymore.
That's why I have different colored bobbers and don't know the names of my clients. Green, reel in. Red, where's your bobber?
I do that with the fishing line. Yeah. Every rod has a different
pink,
color on it.
Pink, set the hook.
I could do it by the bobber color, the line color.
You probably get the most masculine guy, pink line, don't you, Captain Kale?
Bobbers.
Pink bobbers. Okay, that's
pink
right.
Bobbers. Pink bobbers, yes.
Well, ironically, like you guys were just talking, but everything's being reinvented. So in Louisiana, the popping cork revolution has become a sound producer. They put everything under. They'll put a rattle trap in 20 feet of water under popping cork.
Literally, I know one of the first guys to ever put a rattle trap under a popping cork. Jeez. He did it during a tournament, and he tried not to let anybody know, but a guy saw him and then started replicating it. Who would have ever thought a rattle trap under a popping cork?
So much noise.
It's the same thing as a Rockport rattler. Yeah. With the popping cork, you're getting all your noise on the top, but you don't have any down by the shrimp. You put a Rockport Rattler jig head on, and now you've got rattling down by the shrimp and up by the popping cork.
And I could see it working with a rattle trap. Because when I was trolling the river for tarpon, I had to tell my clients, listen, when you cast that out, hold the hell on. Before I put it in gear, you make sure you have that rod in your hand because a tarpon would grab them rattle traps on the drop.
Right as they hit the water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's the other thing about a popping cork, too, though. You get that, you know, so often you cast and get that hit right away.
Sure.
And if you don't get hit, you got to reel it back in, say, with a piece of bait or whatever. But with a popping cork, you can cast it out, and it's like you recast again when you pop the cork.
Right.
So I'd be really curious to see what one of his backwards ones do underneath that popping cork.
I think they'd be excellent.
Believe it or not, taking the over-engineering one step further, the soft plastic performs rather well under hard plastic. The hard plastic, and Frank has them in the shop there, is actually designed a little bit differently. We move the weight slightly forward because we find that the lure may jump up the line and you get a little bit of slack between the cork and the clients miss the hit. So what we did with the hard plastic is we kept that weight slightly forward and it will actually crawl at a tight line in a radius around the cork, so it never creates a slack spot. So as it crawls around,
it keeps the line tight,
and we actually move the weight about 2 or 3 millimeters forward, so we get a little more forward weight. So we did engineer it slightly differently. But back to the popping cork, one of the things I argue with a lot of people with, and I throw most everything under a popping cork, is if I drop the tackle box on the bottom of the boat, that's an artificial sound. But the popping cork sounds like a snook hit. It's not a spooky sound. You can see this in reds a lot. Reds will be working and birds will be all over them. That doesn't scare them.
Right.
But as soon as I drop my rod in the boat, boom, they're all gone. So they listen. They know what noises are good and bad. And in my opinion, popping corks aren't a bad noise.
No.
It's a natural sound
they
constantly hear.
Tell my clients, you know, they'll ask me, well, how do I know if I'm running this right? If I keep looking over my shoulder to see what just hit the surface, you're running it right.
Mm. Exactly. True. Exactly.
Okay. So there's a lot of stuff. Now, you're from Texas.
Yes, sir.
Now, what's the difference fishing in Texas, say, versus fishing in Florida? What's the difference between Florida and Texas? Texas got a lot of open spaces and I think a lot more oyster bottom and stuff than what we do. We have a lot more grass bottoms and stuff, but I don't know for sure. I haven't fished Texas yet.
Well, I grew up in Fort Pierce. I lived there till I was about 14, so I have a good background on both. But Texas, the best thing going for Texas fishing is we have an ugly coast, so nobody wants to build a house on it. So you go Houston, a little farther south, there's another big town. You go Corpus Christi at the end, and then there's nothing there between there and Mexico. So what we get is we got a lot of wide open spaces. You're not fishing at docks. But what we also get is we got a lot of dispersed pressure. You know, you drive, you don't, you maybe go 20 miles in a boat. And so we have a lot of shell, we have a lot of grass, but we have a lot of mud. So we wade around a lot. We don't get a lot of hard sand. You can even see that replicated in the boat designs. That's where that tunnel skiff came from.
You guys have got much, much shallower running boats than even we do. And we've got some shallow running boats.
Oh, yeah. But we rely upon the fact that it's a soft mud bottom, so we circle up and off we go. We can't do that on a hard bottom. Hard bottoms are very rare and far between. You got to go real south Texas if you want to find those. And we run the gamut in the water quality. We do what's called tea with sugar. Kind of wind whipped clear with little sand in it, coffee with cream, which is most people wouldn't fish, but that's Central Texas coast. You can't avoid it. And then down South Texas, it's crystal clear like it is here. So we run the gamut.
See, it's only crystal here for a short while.
Right.
We have a lot less time where it's either murky or muddy or brown or tan. Yeah. The clear months, if we're really lucky, we get 4 or 5 clear months a year. That's just, if you're really lucky. Sometimes it's maybe one or two, and sometimes it doesn't really clear at all. Mm-hmm. And this is not a sight fishing coast. Now, you go to the east coast of Florida, where you've got more Atlantic Ocean interference, and you get a lot more clear water. But you get back in Titusville, where you're back in those bays, now that doesn't clear up there either.
Well, believe it or not, that's where Marker 54 came from, is the Cape Canaveral space area. My granddaddy was a welder on the 39A during the 50s space race, and he would walk down to Marker 54. That's where I cut my teeth. And so he lived on Merritt Island. He'd walk down to Marker 54, and he would make a cast and catch trout that looked like tarpon and redfish that looked like alligators. And he told me those stories from the day I was born to the day he died, and my daddy and his friend went there too. And so when we named the company, we named it after the stories we heard, the Marker 54 stories. And that's in basically the south end of the Mosquito Lagoon, across right there on the Cape,
right
next to 39A.
All right. Well, hey, now we know where it came
the history,
from.
Yeah,
I thought it was like a Texas thing.
No, it's a Florida thing.
So you ended up in Texas because you are a physicist, right?
Yeah, I graduated University of Texas and then finished up at Portland State, and we did radiation-hardened semiconductors my whole life.
Radiation-hardening something conductors.
Computer now, chips that can survive in space.
Okay, because you're dealing with a guy who owns a bait shop, for God's sakes, you know.
You're mad.
I got almost the fourth grade education.
Keep it to one or two syllables.
I envy you, Frank, trust me.
So, like I say, about the only one, well, Kale, you're educated too. You went to college.
Not really.
Course. Did you go to college?
No.
Oh, okay. You're like, I almost got through high school.
I did weird things like read books.
Yeah, okay. But Barry, he's college educated. I almost finished high school, so. Okay, I can. No, I can't pronounce it either. I thought, well, maybe I can pronounce it, but I won't spell it. But, you know, neither one's going to work. But, so, you've been working with computer chips and radiation hardening and stuff. What drew you into the fishing business?
Well, you know, when I got out of college, that was in the 90s, they were recruiting off campus, and so I'd been fishing since I was one. And the only reason I went to Portland was because there was salmon fishing. My other option was Arizona for another company, and I didn't want to live in Arizona because I
had to go way
not a whole lot of water there.
Yeah, no.
Good bass fishing from what I hear, but it's not my cup of tea.
So fishing is dictated where you went for your...
Always dictated where I've lived. That is not an exaggeration.
I get that.
So when I got out of my old company, I kind of semi-retired because I had a little enough runway, and my now ex-wife and I moved to Miami, and that's where I started working on these in Jupiter, Florida. And we lived there for 3 or 4 years, and the old world called me back for a startup in Austin where I grew up. My parents still live there. And I was like, yeah, I just can't pass it up. They want the big idea, big future, big potential, big everything. And I was coming in, I was running it. And the company got acquired, and I just ran out of gas. I didn't want to go into what they were calling AI at the time. I had disagreements on the... And I said, you know what? This happened not too long ago. I'm just going to focus on the lures more. And so most of this year, I've been making that transition into full-time lures. And, you know, Frank may say what he is, but he's my idol. You know, I've always had that fantasy of owning the bait stand at your favorite fishing spot and living sort of that sort of life.
If you have some money, we can talk. After 35 years...
This way of life is up for sale?
this way of life could be bought. You could have legendary tackle store.
But doesn't that make... Isn't that interesting to hear that, you know, you're not the only one in that scenario where you go do, like, the college experience, get a, you know, good mm-hmm. job, everything, but then you always want to go back to, like, fishing, or that's always what brings you back. That's what dictated where you went to college. It's always something that's...
What happened to Barry?
No.
The poor guy. I mean, he went through, did the whole college thing, got his degrees, did all that, and decided, he took a job where he can do his thing and he has some free time, and he's into the fishing. He's a blogger, he's a radio show host, and he's, he's Barry, and he's just into the fishing, but it really drew him from what most people would say a more normal path, you know, like, you know, you got to go to college so you can learn this and go do that and make millions of dollars. And he says, okay, I can make millions of dollars, or I can be a lot happier. So he kind of did what you did. I either going to make a ton of money doing this, or I can be happy doing that.
Well, you can be successful in doing anything you want as long as it's something you want to do. You know, a lot of the guys I worked with really enjoyed being in semiconductor. You know, you see a lot of programmers really like to code. I really like to design things, and the things that I can design that I can afford to do, one of them is fishing lures.
Sure.
I would love to design a global satellite network, and if anybody's got $300 billion, I have a good idea for you. But until that day, I'm going to stick with fishing lures. But it's always been the current that runs through my life, even with...
You know, here we got a guy who could literally set up a global lure network where we would know where all the lures are at the same time and who's hooking a fish and have the lures transmitting data to a satellite to a central point.
It's coming.
Come on, how long would it be before the charter captains have them lynched?
Well, you hear a lot of charter captains say, everybody turn your phone off because, you know, you got that GPS signal following you around, and you hear that a lot.
Well, I tell you what, guys, we're going to come back for part two. And we're going to do more with Josh on our next show. And we're going to call this part one, getting to know each other. And we're going to come back with part two. So, Fish and Frank here, Josh from Marker 54 Lures, Captain Barry, and Captain Kale. Thanks for listening, boys and girls. Catch us on the next one for part two.
You claim that hoeing ain't no fun.
But I can prove it.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing by a shady, weighty pool.